You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold, and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor at 538. With me in the studio, it's just Neil Payne.
Just Neil Payne.
All right, not just Neil Payne. I mean, it's just the two of us, Neil. Not
That's right.
Just Neil. Not that you are an insufficient podcast counterparty.
Can we get the booth to play that song, Just the Two of Us?
Which version?
The Will Smith version, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Allison McCann, who often joins us, is in Iowa for the political season.
Braving the ice.
Exactly. And Kate Fagan is slowly working her way back from book leave. We wanted to ease her way back in. We sent her to a minor league to practice her podcasting.
Also while braving the ice.
Yeah. Double A affiliate where?
Sioux City.
Yeah, Sioux City, that's right. So Kate will be back soon enough. Allison will be back soon enough. In the meantime, you're stuck with Neil and I. And on today's show, we will be discussing the following. Nick Saban and the Alabama Crimson Tide are the national champions again. 538's Andrew Flowers will swing by as we relive Alabama's surprise onside kick in the championship game and try and make sense of Saban's particular genius. And then, last week we mentioned that road teams in this year's NFL playoffs were much better than usual. Sure enough, all four of them won last weekend, though with a few fluke special teams plays thrown in. We'll discuss what happened over the weekend and why there still isn't a Super Bowl favorite. And then we'll talk Alex Ovechkin and the NHL's scoring drought. What do Ovechkin's 500 goals tell us about a league whose box scores are slouching their way towards suckers? Clemson lost its first game of the season Monday night, but it was the loss that mattered most. Alabama beat Clemson 45-40 to win college football's national championship. It was a taut game full of the kind of athletic feats and blown coverages that can make college football so exciting. Here to help us understand what happened is 538's Andrew Flowers. Hi, Andrew.
Hey there.
So it seems like we need to start with that surprise onside kick in the fourth quarter when the game was tied. And Alabama kicked an onside kick and surprising Clemson recovered the onside kick and went on to score a touchdown. Here's Dabo Swinney talking about that kick.
That was a huge, huge play in the game because I felt like we had all the momentum and we're getting ready to get the ball back. We were confident in where we were and, you know, it was a huge play.
So Swinney talks about it being a pivotal play in the game, that it swung the momentum. There's a big play in the game. It seems like usually when we say that about a play in a game, it's sort of hindsight, that we're applying what happened after that play to the play and saying it was a big play. It switched the momentum. But do onside kicks work like that, Neil, or are they different because they're basically a turnover?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's definitely like a strain of when we look back knowing that Alabama has won the game, for instance, we can attribute certain, you know, importance to plays that perhaps we wouldn't have looked at as important if Clemson had won. But I think, you know, tools like win probability added also allow us to look at certain plays' impact given only the information that we had at the time. And when you look at that, you also see that this was like a huge play. And I think it goes to what you were saying about it's a second consecutive possession for a team. It's a free possession. And anytime that happens, it adds to your, you know, chances of winning the game because you're going to score more points when you have another possession compared to your opponent.
Yeah, it was really a bold strategic move by Nick Saban in Alabama. They have posted a much better special teams efficiency rating than Clemson had. And they took advantage of that in the moment. Sharon Katz at our friends in ESPN Stats and Information Group tweeted about how Clemson's win probability changed from 73% to 18% in just a matter of minutes.
Huge.
Yeah, so it was a big play.
Even knowing what we knew at the time, we don't need that retrospect bias, I guess.
So when is the best time to do an onside kick? Because there's a game theory element to this, too, where you want to do it when someone's not expecting it to happen, but sometimes you have to do it out of desperation, obviously. Is a tie game the moment to deploy it because it seems so unlikely?
Right. Certainly in the NFL, there's been some research done on this by Brian Burke, who is now a colleague of ours at ESPN, but he used to run his own blog, and he had done research on this, and he found that when teams are expecting a onside kick, so when their win probability of the kicking team is like 15% or below, the success rate of recovering it is only 20%. That's not very good. It's a real desperation play, and it's made by teams that are in desperate straits because of their win probability.
And the receiving team expects it.
And the receiving team is totally prepared for it. They're aware and they're, you know, ready to recover. However, in other situations, when the team is presumably not expecting it, the receiving team, the success rate of recovery is around 60%. And so Brian looked at, like, okay, well, given this, under normal circumstances of football, what does your recovery rate have to be in order to break even on the exchange? You know, because you are taking a risk. You're giving up something, a lot of field position, if this doesn't work out for you. And so he found that your success rate has to be only 42% in order for it to be worth it under normal
42% circumstances. 42%. You take an outside kick, you need to recover for it to work. So
right.
If you have a great special teams unit, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. that can recover five out of 10 onside kicks, then you should be onside kicking every kickoff.
Sure. And it's also important to note that that is like really almost exactly between the odds of recovering it if the defense is expecting it versus if they're not expecting it. And it sort of is this convergence point of, you know, your odds change based on whether it's an expected situation or not. The other thing that he found was that 42% success rate under normal circumstances sort of undersells what you have to do, because most of the time when this is happening, it's happening in the fourth quarter. Even when it is unexpected, it's happening in really crucial situations. And so when he looked at it from sort of baking in the leverage of the situation in the game, he found that you only need to recover 25% of the time for it to be worth the gamble. And that's not that much more than the if the defense is expecting it probability. So in that case, teams might need to be onside kicking more. One other note from Brian Burke's research is that he was trying to figure out when is the best time to do it in terms of, you know, the time of the game and also the situation in which it makes the most sense. And so he looked at, like, if you're down a touchdown, if you're tied, or if you're up a touchdown. And he found that if you're tied, which was pertinent to last night's game, that the best time to do it is in the fourth quarter, and it's a huge advantage relative to any other situation in which you would do a surprise onside kick. And that's exactly what Nick Saban did in the game last night.
Exactly. And one more number to throw into this mix. And so this research done by Brian Burke was on NFL,
NFL games.
Situations. Again, our friends at Stats and Info posted a number that this year in college football, for onside kicks attempted outside of the last 5 minutes of the game, so the supposed, you know, surprise onside kicks, the recovery rate was 36%. So just under that 42% number that Burke estimated. So it's right on the line, and it's a bold move. So,
but also very different from the NFL average that Brian found. And I don't know if that's just the vagaries of, you know, the sample that's involved, or says something about the difference between college and pro kickers.
Yeah, maybe college kickers just can't execute it well.
So can we move to Nick Saban, who seems to be a Tom Izzo-ish figure in college football? We've talked about Tom Izzo quite a bit on Hot Takedown when Michigan State made their run to the Final Four with what many agree was an inferior Michigan State team this March and April. And it seems like this is another situation where we have to evaluate both the system and the talent. And I wonder if you guys agree with that read, where, you know, I want us to both talk about Saban as his legacy and where he ranks all time, but first, how much of this is about Saban and how much of this is about, you know, the athletes? This is a knot that we always try and untangle here.
Well, yeah, I mean, so Izzo in college basketball is kind of defined by this idea of, well, he does a lot with a lot of players who are not necessarily NBA prospects. They're not like the one-and-done type players. They're more like seniors and, you know, less talented, conventionally speaking, players. Whereas with Nick Saban, it's just the talent that he has on his rosters at Alabama is mind-blowing. And we looked this this up. We looked at the recruiting rankings across the whole country, so including all 120 or so FBS teams over the past since 2009. So starting in 2015, going back to 2009, Alabama ranked first, third, fifth, first. So he had a top five recruiting class in each of the past 6-7 years, and then also, you know, was first more than half of the time.
Okay, so not Tom Izzo. I retract that that assertion then. It seems pretty clear.
But, well, they're both great coaches, though.
But another aspect of how you evaluate a college coach, besides recruiting, which obviously Saban's great at, is also game preparation and game management. And if you, we just talked about his execution of a risky, bold onside kick, and how well prepared his teams are is famous. So you have to give him credit for that. But in terms of his legacy, whether he's one of the greatest college coaches of all time, the recruiting, I don't think you should detract from that.
No.
Because that's part of your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
But while Nick Saban's recruiting dominance may give you caution about elevating him to the greatest college coach of all time, you have to give credit to him for doing this in an era of SEC competition that is cutthroat and intense. He is at LSU and then now at Alabama, won these national titles in arguably the nation's toughest conference, and that should contribute towards his legacy, in addition to the fact that his style is in some ways not very innovative. It's kind of traditional in a sense. Strong defense, kind of conventional play calling often on offense. And to do that with the talent he does, I think speaks to his talent, his expertise as a coach in preparing his players.
Now, do we think that this championship run that they had this year showed off the versatility, though, in some way, maybe even like the hidden versatility where, yeah, Saban would prefer to play the sort of pound the ball, play defense mode, but in a shootout like Monday night's game, they rose to the occasion. They were able to, you know, sling it around with Clemson, you know, punch for punch.
Yeah, and so for the most of the season, well, in the early part of the season, they were trying to replicate what they had last year in this kind of pass-heavy offense. That didn't work.
With Amari Cooper.
Yeah, exactly.
Which helps.
Exactly. So Amari Cooper's gone to the NFL. You lose to Ole Miss. Lane Kiffin and Nick Saban rewrite their playbook. They started giving it to Derrick Henry, and they have a kind of a conventional offense, and they win the rest of their games. But they almost used Derrick Henry as a decoy these last two games. As Neil said, they go back to kind of more innovative play calling the last two games, more of a passing attack, and it throws their opponents off guard.
Okay, I think we should leave it there. Despite Nick Saban's dominance, he's now has five championships, one short of Bear Bryant, one of his predecessors at Alabama, and there's nothing to suggest that he's not eventually gonna get to that figure. So we'll have to be back here in a year talking about whether or not Nick Saban has climbed that mountain. Andrew, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
May you have 8 months in which you do not think about anything involving college football.
Ah, it's a sad thought.
Okay, moving on. I'd say that it was a weird slate of NFL wildcard games, but we knew it was going to be a weird slate of games already, as we discussed last week. All the worst-seeded teams won, though by the slimmest of margins in two cases. So what are we to make of all this? Ross Tucker from the Ross Tucker Football Podcast tells us that we shouldn't make much of anything. We should not generalize.
Is everybody's going to talk about, oh, the road team won every game, or, you know, the team with the better quarterback won every game? Really? I mean, if you watch the Bengals game or the Vikings game, are you really going to sit here and try to make huge generalizations? So I don't want to hear these, yep, as expected, the better quarterback won every game. I told you, don't listen to that BS, because that's exactly what it is, BS.
Neil, if I sit here and tell you that, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers are champions and their grit determined that that they won against Cincinnati, or that the Seahawks, you know, it was just the belief in the team. They worked hard. They believed they were going to win. That's why they won. So they're going to the Super Bowl. What would you say to that?
I'd say, you know, you're entitled to that opinion.
I thought it was BS.
Neil. No. We can't say anything on Hot Takedown is definitively BS. We can just paint
only
pictures.
Only with a confidence interval.
Right, with confidence intervals and numbers.
So, but seriously, what do you think of Tucker's point that basically any one weekend, especially a weird wild card weekend like that, isn't instructive and we can't make any larger points?
I would be inclined to agree with like the general idea that you shouldn't generalize from just one weekend of games and the sample size of one NFL game. We've talked about this in the past. It's not really all that predictive, and it doesn't tell you that much. One team would have to win by in excess of, I believe, like 30 or 35 points based on research I've done in the past for you to definitively say with any kind of confidence that the team that won was better than the other team.
So the Chiefs were better than the Texans.
That is probably true. Okay. But see, the weird thing about what he's saying is that he seems to be saying that you can't derive the idea that, for instance, that Pittsburgh is better than Cincinnati, an A.J. McCarron quarterback Cincinnati, we should say, and that Seattle is better than Minnesota based on what happened. And yeah, they were lucky to win because they relied on a very unlikely sequence of events to win. But that if we look at all of the power ratings and all of the statistical indicators from the entire season, and that's 17 games now, those were the better teams. The better teams did win those games. They may not have won in convincing fashion, and they may have been fortunate to win. So it's kind of a weird thing where, yeah, he's kind of right, and he's kind of right for the wrong reason, almost.
Okay, so what did the weekend also tell us? Anything that we can take home? I read on 538, you say that it reminded us that special teams are fluky, because what happened in two of the games is that they were basically determined by special teams, and that those are events that, as we were just talking about, don't suggest the quality of a team.
Right, yeah, and maybe it tells us that special teams take on an outsized importance relative to how mm-hmm. predictive that they are. So, you can be a really good team, in terms of offense and defense, which are far more predictive from week to week and season to season, but you can be undone by a special teams, a sequence of special teams plays that, can take a huge impact. Like, for instance, in the Kansas City-Houston game, which was won by the better team, but a whole touchdown of their points, according to expected points added, of the margin by which Kansas City won, is directly attributable to their special teams, when before the game we would have predicted based on the regular season that they'd have been about even in that category. So yeah, these things take on extra magnification in the playoffs, but also just going to the point of who won and how weird it was. Again, the better teams won, and that's what's setting us up for kind of a more interesting playoffs as the playoffs go on, is if the home teams had won any of those games or the majority of those games, and perhaps we would have expected that in a normal year, then the teams that are playing at home in the divisional round, the bye teams, would have had an easier path to the Super Bowl. But because a team like Seattle is still there, because Kansas City is still there, those teams are now, those games are closer games, and the top-seeded teams have a much tougher road to the Super Bowl.
And so we should get better football to watch as well.
Yes.
So you also wrote on 538 this week that there is no Super Bowl favorite at this mm-hmm. stage of the game. And is that atypical for this early? Not this early, but a week into NFL playoffs?
I think so. I mean, obviously, there. If we had to gun to our head, pick a team that was favored, we would pick a team. And right now, Elo says that team is the Carolina Panthers. But they have an 18% chance of winning. Next up is Arizona at 16%, KC and Denver at 14%. So it's just so incredibly bunched that picking one team over another is not necessarily going to be so clear cut as in the past, because in the past, going into the playoffs, the number one ELO team in the league typically wins the Super Bowl about a third of the time. And last year we saw that increase. Seattle was the number one ranked team going into the playoffs. It increased to nearly 40% after wildcard weekend because of the teams that, dropped out and the teams that they had in front of them potentially as roadblocks. So I think it is very abnormal to see a team, the number one most likely Super Bowl team right now, to only be, around 15 to 20%.
We should pause here so I can give my usual throat-clearing disclaimer about ELO being
sure.
a performance rating system that is 538's pet ranking measurement. So, that number one team is a 15-1 team as well. And we've talked about the Panthers here before. But it just seems very interesting to me that the Chiefs, which is another team that was not necessarily forecasted to be as good as they've appeared to be this season. They weren't forecasted to be that good coming into the season, similar to the Panthers. And the difference in their Super Bowl odds are 4 percentage points, which doesn't seem like a ton, considering that they're, you know, the Panthers were 15-1. And I wonder why it is that Elo has been, to me at least, sort of kinder to the Chiefs in a way and to their run than hasn't to the Panthers.
Well, we should say that Kansas City started the season with a slightly higher ELO than Carolina did on the basis of what both teams did last year. You know, neither team really had a very great year last year in a lot of ways. And also, surprising as it might be, because Carolina was 15-1, but Kansas City actually had a better point differential during the season if you adjust for strength of schedule, which is what Pro Football Reference does with their simple rating system. So, yeah, based on what ELO is looking at, and ELO does give extra credit to wins more so than some other statistical systems, but they're basically looking at two teams that started out, you know, pretty much the same. Kansas City a slight edge, and then in the eyes of point differential, Kansas City had the better year against tougher competition, and so, you know, that's why you're seeing that. But I think the Super Bowl odds are different because of something else that's important, and we talked about it last week, of the seedings and how Carolina, you know, has an easier path to the Super Bowl playing at home, being the number one seed, than Kansas City does. But because of this compression and the parity in the playoffs right now, they may very well meet each other in the Super Bowl.
Okay. I think it's time for Donald Trump to make his hot takedown debut.
How is this possible that he has not? He just doesn't weigh in on sports enough, I guess.
Well, there was the whole Tom Brady-Trump fracas where Brady said Trump was a great friend of his or some such, or maybe Trump said that. And Brady did not seem ready and willing to denounce any of Trump's more inflammatory statements. And that led to various run-ins on talk radio. But a few days ago, Donald Trump weighed in on the state of the NFL and said this.
So I'm watching the game yesterday. What used to be considered a great tackle, a violent head-on, a violent, used to see these tackles, and it was incredible to watch, right? Now they tackle. Oh, head-on-head collision. 15-yard. The whole game is all screwed up. Football's become soft.
That was before the Pittsburgh-Cincinnati game.
No, that was
in
before.
In which Roethlisberger and Antonio Brown were injured during play, and it was generally a very chippy, aggressive game. Chippy is such a strange football-only euphemism. You know, you never say chippy.
You hear it in hockey, too.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Hear it in,
but
in
out
contact
in public,
sports.
You know, if you're watching a bar fight about to go down, you don't say, oh, that bar is getting chippy.
No.
You know, you just say, like, that a fight's about to happen. Anyway, so I want to talk about the NFL getting soft for a second. We had an aborted mission to read out concussion stats every week at this podcast before, but I just want to check back in on that because it relates to what Trump was saying. According to PBS's concussion tracker, there have been 197 concussions in this NFL season. That is higher than 2014, 2013, and 2012, despite the new rules.
But
and
it's
the
so
NFL
much softer now.
Soft. So while I appreciate Mr. Trump's hot take armchair quarterbacking of the NFL's rule systems, it does seem as though the hits keep coming. Obviously, the protocols around
right. I think they're getting reported more often,
right.
In some ways.
And it's certainly the case that the players are trying to tackle differently. We've heard a lot of anecdotal reporting around that. But it's not as though it's flag football out there.
No.
Donald. So that's my quick
that's
rebuttal.
Your counter hot take.
Yeah, that's my quick rebuttal to the Don. All right, Neil. Shall we leave the NFL behind until next week when surely some other crazy thing will have happened.
We never truly leave the NFL behind, but we'll move on for right now.
On Sunday night, Alex Ovechkin scored his 500th career goal while playing for the Capitals, becoming the 43rd NHL player to join the club and the first new member in 5 seasons. Here's George McPhee, the former GM of the Capitals, on Ovechkin's place in the NHL all time.
When we were playing, you know, the game was a little more wide open and the goalies weren't as good as they are. And I think he's certainly the best goal scorer of this generation and probably the best of all time. I wouldn't be surprised if this guy got another 500 goals.
Whoa. Double trouble. So some in McPhee's statement, though, was something about how it's harder to score in the NHL these days than it used to be. And, Neil, do the stats bear that out?
Yeah, I think no matter what you look at, you find that goals per game are hard to come by. And, you know, that this takes a toll on someone like Ovechkin's stats. Like, going back to what McPhee said, he said that Ovechkin was the best goal scorer ever, or might be. If you look at goals per game in NHL history, he ranks fifth all time. But there's also this factor of, you know, league-wide goal scoring being lower. And if you look at something that Hockey Reference has, which is called adjusted stats, Ovechkin's numbers.
Sorry, that's what it's called, adjusted stats.
Right. It's not a very creative name that they've put for these things.
But like, this is just for goals. It's an adjusted goal.
They do it for goals, assists, and points.
Okay. So it's a category of stats.
It's a category of stats in which they basically try to translate a player's raw numbers for the environment in which he played by sort of normalizing his environment of goals per game to this sort of like long-term historical NHL average. I forget the number of goals per game, but basically the upshot is that Ovechkin plays in an era that depresses goals by 17% relative to the long-term NHL average. So while he has 500 and change goals, I think 503 now, he would have 603 if he had played in a more normal era. We'd be talking about his 600th goal, and that takes a
20% of the way towards his next 500.
Right, that takes a toll on his stats. So if you look at the goals per game leaderboard after making this adjustment that Hockey Reference does, you find that Ovechkin is number three all time, and he's behind two guys named Howie Morenz and Nels Stewart, who probably none of our listeners have ever heard of, because they last played in the 1930s. So if you take all of that into account, I think McPhee is probably right that Ovechkin is on a per game basis. Ovechkin is probably the best goal scorer in NHL history, but you wouldn't know it by looking at the raw numbers. And that goes to what you were saying about the change in the league over time.
And you wouldn't know it just by thinking about whether more people know his name than Wayne Gretzky's. I mean, I feel like that's partly about the NHL not being the cultural force, which maybe is a bit of a strong statement that it was in the
80s, it was a real force, Chad.
a cultural presence, shall we say. So, something standing in the room of culture,
sure.
In the 80s and 90s compared to now. But it does seem like from the outside, from a non-hockey diehard, I certainly was not going to tell you that Alex Ovechkin was the best player of all time in hockey. And is that just because we've got to get our heads around this scoring slowdown?
Yeah, I think we're aware of it, but we're not really necessarily aware of the depths to which goal scoring is taken. And for those watching on video, we even have a chart where we've shown exactly how the trajectory of goals per game in the NHL has gone. And you mentioned Wayne Gretzky. During the 1980s, goal scoring, and this is per team per game in the NHL, was around the 4 goals per game mark, which is really high. It was a high water period historically, even certainly since the league expanded beyond 6 teams in the late 60s. And ever since then, it has gone down pretty steadily, especially since the 90s started. And for those who listened to our podcast last week about the millennials entering the NBA, we did this thing where we looked at the effect of basically, you know, over time, how the quality of play in the league has changed in the NBA, and that we could see the ebbs and flows as the result of expansion and kind of worst players entering the league. I think that's a little bit of what you're seeing in the NHL too, because they began aggressively expanding the league around the late 80s and early 90s and throughout the 90s. And that coincided with this dip in scoring that really sort of reached its low point, at least in the modern era, right the season before the lockout that cost the league an entire season in 2005. So the 2004 season was sort of this low point, and they had to reassess during the lockout of, you know, what are we going to do to increase scoring when we do come back and start playing again.
Wouldn't expansion also affect the quality of defense and goalies? You seem to be laying it on the feet of the attack getting worse during expansion, but wouldn't that affect everyone? Or and because McPhee seems to suggest that the goalies are getting better.
Yeah, that's a great point, because in the past, I think whenever the NHL expanded, you saw goal scoring increase. For instance, we have on this chart, you know, I mentioned that the first round of expansion took place in the late 60s, early 70s, and that was a period in which goal scoring went up, and it only really kind of leveled out when the World Hockey Association started kind of poaching players, and there was this, you know, similar to the NBA where there was this rival league and they didn't get that settled, and then once they did get that settled and brought in some new teams, again the league scoring went up like gangbusters. So I think historically there was a trend toward every time that the league expanded you would see more scoring, not less, and so it's been something that's pretty difficult to explain. But to his point about goaltenders getting better, that's something that is a very clear trend. If you look at save percentage across the league, which is the percentage of shots on goal that a goalie stops versus lets into the goal behind him, it steadily increases since they've been able to track it in 1984. And this year, in fact, is the highest save percentage season ever by goalies. Goalies, in terms of just stopping pucks, are better than ever. And that's what's really interesting about like trying to suss out the causes of why the league doesn't have the scoring rates that it used to, is if you look at like shots per game, it's relatively flat. Shots per game are a little bit down versus when the league first came back from the lockout. And I should say that over the lockout, the league put in some rules that they thought would kind of spice up play, that would encourage more goal scoring.
Rules are two-line passes.
They got rid of the two-line pass. They tweaked some of the dimensions of the ice and tried to made the promise, as always, that they would cut down on some of the, you know, clutching and grabbing that plagued the game throughout the 90s when the neutral zone trap was sort of ruling, and that's a system of play that really discouraged goal scoring and theoretically would discourage shooting. But the weird thing is that, again, the shooting numbers have not changed that much. It's the save percentage, it's the rate at which they're stopping shots that have really changed. And then the other thing that's interesting is you would think, oh well, maybe power plays are less effective, that, you know, because it's such an advantage to play against a team that's a man down, that, you know, maybe any tweak that took place to the effectiveness of power play units would dramatically affect goal scoring. And power play percentage, in terms of the number of chances on the power play that result in a goal, is also relatively flat compared to historical norms. In fact, if anything, in 2016 so far, it's up versus the surrounding seasons. But the number of power play chances per game has gone down a lot, and especially if you look at the 80s and the heyday of the game.
And that's because of fewer penalties being called?
Yeah, fewer penalties being called. They used to have, you know, coincidental minors, things that, you know, you could strategically take a minor penalty and you would also get your opponent into a minor, and then you would open up 4-on-4 instead of 5-on-5 on the ice. And that sort of the spirit of that went into a rules change for this season, in which the NHL has adopted a 3-on-3 format for overtime. And that seems to be working, in the sense that fewer games are going to the shootout. They're scoring and shooting the puck a lot more in overtime than they do during the regular play. And that's what you would expect. There's two fewer players on the ice than there normally is. But it just, you know, for whatever reason, they haven't been able to crack through rule changes this you know, depression of scoring.
And
especially
a Neil Payne deep dive about why save percentage is so high.
Well, you might. In fact, we actually did something like that, I think, in the early months of 538.
You may have edited that. Something that
but,
already
but it's really interesting to think about. The NHL has been one of the more proactive leagues in terms of tweaking the rules and trying to figure out, you know, how do we game things so that we put out a better product? And they've spent, you know, some of their efforts have been misguided. They still give out a point for an overtime or shootout loss, which encourages sort of perverse incentives about, you know, how teams play at the end of regulation. They play for a tie and then they try to get into overtimes where they're assured of a point. But at the same time, they've also tried a lot of these other things that we mentioned before, and they really haven't figured it out. So, you know, I come bearing problems, but I don't necessarily come bearing solutions. But it's something to keep an eye on. And I think it makes Ovechkin, just to kind of circle back to him, even more impressive from a historical standpoint, because, you know, since there are 43 members of the 500 goal club, Ovechkin has done it in a period of scoring that perhaps is lower, the lowest of any of them, or as low as any of them. And I hope that he gets the credit that he does when we're sort of, there's some distance historically between us and his career, and we're assessing him. I think, you know, he will be one of the bright shining shining lights of this otherwise kind of low goal.
You're always thinking about
period.
Legacies, Neil. You're That's such right. a mensch. You always want people to get their due.
That's right. I'm always looking out for Alex the Great.
You should be like you should be. I think agents should be able to contract you to like attend negotiations for salary, right?
And so they totally have stat heads that come in and do that.
They have freelance stat heads.
I think
the agents have the packets, have advanced stats on the packets when it helps their clients out. But it would be more effective if you were there in person and you basically delivered a hot takedown style soliloquy about the player and then just said, I'll take my leave. Scott Boras.
Just the mic
take
drop.
The floor.
The
Absolutely.
Mic drop. But, you know, I believe, and I could be wrong about this, but I think that Bill James, before he was hired for the Red Sox as an assistant, actually worked on the other side and was helping players and agents make presentations about, you know, players' true values. So, you know, if any agents are listening, I don't know.
Neil Payne, labor crusader. All right, Neil, thanks very much for this Alex Ovechkin download.
No problem.
All right, now it is time for our significant digit. When a number that tells us something about the world of sports comes to us, usually in the form of Allison McCann, but Allison is in Iowa this week, so instead we have yanked our loyal and faithful producer, Joe Sykes, out of the studio to come give us the sig dig. Joe, how you doing?
Hey, Chad. How's it going?
Joe, listeners have only heard the sweet nothings of your voice in a recorded hot take. This is your live debut on the show.
I feel nervous. Yeah? I feel nervous. Yeah.
It's just being on the other side of the mic. It just amps that anxiety.
The breath has got a little short and, you know, come on, let's get on with it. Come on.
All right. You don't want to drag this out so you can live in your nerves. All right. Joe, what have you brought us this week?
So the sig dig today is 80, which is Lionel Messi's minutes per goal rate, which means he scores a goal every 80 minutes. And last night, Messi won the Ballon d'Or for the fifth time, which is the award for the best footballer in the world, voted by various dignitaries and journalists, etc., etc.
Are they as corrupt as FIFA, or we trust this one?
I think a little more trustworthy, okay. Although there's definitely some corruption in there somewhere.
Okay. So every 80 minutes...
We should note that games are 90 minutes.
Right.
So he
that's
is
a
scoring,
good detail.
and that's not including extra time, so he is scoring more than one goal per 90 minutes.
Yeah, and so his stats this year are pretty exceptional. He's played 61 games in 2015. He scored 52 goals and made 26 assists, which is extraordinary. But just behind him, or even level with him stats-wise, is Cristiano Ronaldo. And these two have really dominated the Ballon d'Or for the last 6 years. I think the last person to win the Ballon d'Or who wasn't Ronaldo or Messi was in 2007.
Oh, so that might be seven years.
7 years. Years.
Depends on how you do your math.
Something like that. In England, we have different maths. Yeah.
And Chad, you edited Ben Morris, our colleague's epic Lionel Messi. I don't even know what you would call it—a paean to him,
an ode
to him. And in his charts, frequently you saw those two names just rise head and shoulders and perhaps waist level above everyone else in all of competitive football.
Yeah, it seems to me that we're going to move on from this era at some point, 5-10 years from now, whenever it's going to be. And we're not going to know what to do without this sort of like remarkable rivalry at the top. And we just got done talking about the NFL and the parity in the NFL this year. And I sort of go back and forth on this argument about whether parity or dominance is better for a league. But I think for when it comes to athletes, dominance is better. That you want transcendent stars in your league. You don't want a flat hierarchy.
These guys are the best there's ever been, really. And I mean, if you look at Ronaldo's stats, you know, in 2015, he scored 57 goals in 57 appearances for club and country. He outscored Messi in La Liga by 37-34 and the Champions League, but he didn't win the Ballon d'Or because Messi won the trophies. And so this isn't really an award about stats, but it's about winning and
holistic
about
accomplishment.
Exactly. But these guys, you know, they're only getting better, and it's exciting.
All right, very good. Joe, how was it? Now that you're done with the sig dig, how was it on the other side?
I might need a couple of months, I think.
Yeah, you're not ready to come back? All right, Allison's back from Iowa next
Great.
Week.
Great, so thank God.
Worry. Yeah. All right, Joe Sykes, thanks very much for our sig dig.
Thanks, Chad.
All right, that'll do it for this week's show. Neil Payne, thanks for putting up with my slightly more nasal drawl this week as I recover from a sickness.
You're a gamer.
This is my Willis Reed
play
podcast.
Through. Exactly. You're playing through pain.
We might have made that joke already on this podcast. Not this
Never
edition,
can do too many Willis Reed references.
One. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast overlord is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Ryan Mantell, Tony Chow, and Christine Laskowski. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.